from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The U.S. military has announced plans to dispatch a team of advisors to Ukraine in a bid to assist Kiev in its military confrontation with pro-Russia forces in the east of the country. We have this report from Press TV.
Pentagon spokesperson Colonel Steve Warren told the Washington Times that the U.S. will be sending the advisors to Ukraine in the next few weeks. They will be going overseas to, quote, shape and establish an enduring program to support the Ukrainian military through training, education, and assistance. The Pentagon has also approved sending a large shipment of military equipment, including night vision devices, explosive robots, and communication equipment. The alleged downing of a Malaysian Airlines passenger plane over Ukraine last week has considerably raised tensions between the West and Moscow.
Meanwhile, political infighting in Kiev, some of which actually came to blows in the Ukrainian parliament on Tuesday and Wednesday, resulted in the resignation Thursday of Ukraine's prime minister. We have this report from Press TV.
The Ukrainian prime minister has officially stepped down. Arseniy Yatsenyuk handed in his resignation in protest at the disbanding of the ruling parliamentary coalition. He told the Ukrainian parliament that his resignation is because of the, quote, dissolution of the parliamentary coalition and blocking of government initiatives.
Prime Minister Yatsenyuk resigned after the two largest remaining political parties in the post-coup parliament said they would pull out of the governing European Choice Coalition. That comes after 2 days of heated confrontations over the majority coalition's attempt to unseat Communist Party members of parliament and outlaw the party, a move that the Speaker of the Parliament, Alexander Turchynov, called, quote, his historic mission, closed quote. The Prime Minister also expressed disappointment with Parliament's decision to reject a bill allowing the government to hand over up to 49% of the country's gas transport system to investors from the EU and the U.S. The far-right Svoboda Party and the UDAR movement, led by former boxer Vladimir Klitschko, both pulled out of the ruling bloc, which has ruled the country since a coup ousted the former president Viktor Yanukovych earlier this year. Prime Minister Yatsenyuk said, with the collapse of the coalition, Parliament could no longer function as a legislative body. Meanwhile, Iraq finally seems to be on the road to forming a new government. Iraq's parliament elected senior Kurdish politician Fuad Masum as the president Thursday. The election is the second step in the process of forming a government. Politicians have been in deadlock over forming a new government since elections in April. The next step is to choose a prime minister. Shiite Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has ruled since the election in a caretaker capacity, despite demands from Sunnis and Kurds that he step aside for a less divisive figure. The shelling of a UN school in Gaza by the Israeli military has resulted in at least 15 deaths among the refugees sheltering there. Jocelyn Sambira reports from the UN.
Many people have died while others have been injured by incoming Israeli fire at a UN school in the northern city of Beit Hanun in Gaza. Adnan Abu Hasna, spokesperson for the UN Relief Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, confirmed the news on Thursday. The location of the school and the fact that it was housing displaced persons had been formally communicated to Israel, he said. The schools serve as shelter for people displaced in the Gaza Strip from the current fighting. UNRWA premises are clearly marked with a UN flag. According to Mr. Hasna, there is no safe place in Gaza. UNRWA has had 3 direct hits from Israeli fire on 2 schools in central Gaza in the past 3 days. The agency also reported its first fatalities after 3 of its teachers were killed in the airstrikes. A further serious concern to UNRWA is that of respect for the neutrality of its installations. More rockets were found in a school on Wednesday for the second time since the current conflict began. The number of displaced people in the UN schools now exceeds 140,000 in 83 facilities.
Meanwhile, the U.S. Secretary of State is back in Egypt after his visit to Israel about the current fighting. Press TV's Karim Gamal El-Dayin reports from Cairo.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry returned to Egypt after a short trip to Israel to discuss the Egyptian ceasefire initiative. Kerry had traveled to Tel Aviv after meeting Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi in Cairo and then returned in the same day. Little progress is being made in regards to reaching an agreement after Hamas refused the Egyptian initiative. Hamas says it wasn't consulted about the deal and that the deal does not contain terms and conditions, including the opening of the Rafah border crossing with Egypt.
The Egyptian initiative this year is nothing different from an Israeli initiative. It is meant to save Israel, and everybody should know that this initiative is predestined to fail. There is no difference between July 2014 on Gaza and July 2006 on Lebanon. Israel will be defeated.
Egypt was capable under Morsi to broker a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel, but since then, relations have deteriorated following the fall of Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi. The current regime views both the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas as terrorist groups. On the ground, regular Egyptians are demanding that their government takes more practical steps to support Palestinians.
The Egyptian government should open the border. Our Palestinian brothers are suffering from the Israeli war, and it's our duty to help them overcome this crisis.
The main reason behind Hamas's refusal of the Egyptian proposal is that despite the bloodshed suffered by Palestinians, that nothing will change in terms of the siege on Gaza, an issue that all Palestinian factions said must come to an end.
While Egypt's President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi is pushing for a truce, calls are rising on Cairo to ease Gaza restrictions and allow injured Palestinians and humanitarian aid cross the border. Karim Gamaluddin, Press TV, Cairo.
Another UN human rights official has condemned the situation facing Gazans as the Israeli assaults, on the heels of years of tough sanctions imposed by Israel, has led to severe shortages of food, water, and medicine. This comes on the heels of a vote on Wednesday by the UN Human Rights Council to investigate claims of war crimes in the Israeli siege. But Israel's prime minister shook off the criticism from UN human rights officials. We have this report from Press TV.
The UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, Valerie Amos, also called terrible the current situation in the impoverished enclave. She says brokering a ceasefire to put an end to violence in Gaza is absolutely vital. The UN official has also called for major changes in delivery of relief as funding falls short because of growing number of conflicts across the globe. With crises in Iraq, Syria and elsewhere, the UN funding appeals have risen to a record $16.9 billion in 2014 to help more than 50 million people. The number stood at 6 billion in 2004. The Israeli Prime Minister has dismissed the UN Human Rights Council's condemnation of Tel Aviv as grotesque.
What is equally grotesque is that Israel was condemned in the Human Rights Council. It's a travesty of justice. It's a travesty of fairness. It's a travesty of common sense. It's a travesty of truth. And I think that it will not prevent us from continuing to act to defend our people.
At a joint press conference with the British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond in Jerusalem al-Quds, Benjamin Netanyahu once again put the blame on Hamas and the Islamic Jihad for the death of Palestinian civilians. Elsewhere, the UK's Foreign Secretary, who's been in office for only 9 days, supported Israel, saying Tel Aviv has the right to defend itself. Hammond also fell short of blaming Israel for its crimes against innocent people of Gaza and held Hamas accountable for the current cycle of violence.
Britain has been very clear, I have been very clear, Prime Minister Cameron has been very clear, that this current cycle of violence was triggered by Hamas firing hundreds of rockets at Israeli towns and cities indiscriminately and in breach of international humanitarian law.
The joint news conference came a day after the UN Human Rights Council agreed to launch a probe into crimes committed by Israel during its military offensive in the Gaza Strip. The U.S. was the only country which voted against this decision.
Protests in response to Israel's assault on Gaza have drawn hundreds and, in some cases, thousands around the world. On Tuesday, New York, which has seen a number of such protests in the past weeks, drawing larger and larger crowds, saw yet another.
The following people were killed on Tuesday, July 8th. Mohammed Shaban, age 24.
Mohammed Shaban, age 24.
He was killed in a bombing of his car in Gaza City. The following men were also killed in the same bombing. Ahmed Shaban, age 30.
Ahmed Shaban, age 30.
Hader Al-Bashaliki, age 45.
That was the sound at the Manhattan headquarters of the Friends of the Israeli Defense Forces, a tax-exempt organization that provides support for the Israeli military with 17 regional offices in the U.S. and Panama. The office was occupied by protesters, largely comprised of members of two Jewish anti-war groups, Jewish Voice for Peace and Jews Say No, who read the names of Palestinians killed in the past 2 weeks by Israel's assault on Gaza. Nine of the protesters were arrested when they refused to leave the premises.
We are a peaceful Jewish people.
Good afternoon, folks. I'm Inspector Winsky from the NYPD. You are trespassing in on private property. I'm going to give you an opportunity to leave, and if you choose to leave, you can leave now. If not, you're going to be arrested. So anyone that wants to leave can leave now.
Among those arrested were the daughter and granddaughter of Holocaust survivors, the executive director of Jewish Voice for Peace, and a young paralegal who went on an Israeli-sponsored propaganda trip to Israel, which had the opposite effect. We spoke with that paralegal, Brandon Davis, who is the member of Jewish Voices for Peace, who read the names of the Palestinian victims as the group occupied the Friends of the IDF office in Manhattan Tuesday.
There's this assumption in the U.S. media and U.S. political sphere that Jews are unanimously supportive of Israel, and that's simply not the case. And we are certainly not supportive of Israel's most recent assault on the Gaza Strip. We occupy the Friends of the IDF office because they are directly supporting that attack. At one point, I believe one of the employees of the office was saying, we are not a political organization, and we reject that line. If you're funding the Israeli military, you are a political organization. Fundamentally disagree with you. That should not be you do not speak for Jewish people, and you, this should not be, this is not, some sort of banal, charitable action. You are funding, military occupation, and massacre.
Right. And, when you were there, you read the names of, the people that have been killed. That numbered on Tuesday better than 600, I guess, around 600. It's up over 700.
Yeah, and it might have been approaching 700 at that point. I can't remember. It was quite upsetting. We were there for about an hour and a half, I would say. And I think we got through maybe, 5 days. It just goes to show the magnitude of this most recent assault. We read the names of those who have been killed by the Israeli military, funded obviously in part by Friends of the IDF, along with the U.S. government, and then we also had some chants and songs to remember those people who have been killed, and also to protest the general pro-Israel lobby.
Still more questions than answers about the shootdown of Malaysian Airlines Flight 17. Today, a peek at how a CNN journalist interacted with an American-born and raised journalist now based in Moscow. As the U.S. continues to lay the blame for the shootdown of the plane at the feet of Russia, specifically Russian President Vladimir Putin, neither U.S. government officials nor mainstream U.S. news agencies seem to be able to discuss any facts surrounding the investigation. On Wednesday morning, Peter Lavelle, who hosts the program Crosstalk on the Russian-based international news agency RT, was surprised to learn that he had been asked to appear on CNN to discuss the situation with their reporter and co-host of CNN's morning program, Chris Cuomo. This is an excerpt from that 10-minute discussion.
Maybe you haven't been following it, but the U.S. is actually coming out with a lot of its own intelligence that connects what happened to MH17 to the acts of Russian militants and perhaps to the involvement of Russia in either training, equipping, or maybe even assisting
in
this horrible operation of bringing down this plane.
What forensic evidence are you talking about? What forensic evidence are you referring to? Twitter?
They are releasing intelligence information about the trajectory. No, not Twitter. I do not think, Peter, this is something to be flip about. 298 people lost their lives. Let's not play politics.
I think the U.S. State Department has been very flippant about
it.
Very flippant about it.
We spoke with Peter Laveau about the incident and got his take on the general condition of relations between the U.S. and Russia via Skype from Moscow Thursday. I do a radio program that starts at 6 a.m. in New York time weekdays, and I do it from home. And when I got up around 6:30, 20 to 7, I walked out into the living room to refill my coffee, and I looked on the TV screen where I had CNN, and I saw your face there.
I was shocked. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, yeah. I said, I know that guy. So when I turned the sound up, I caught what was one of the most remarkable pieces of television that I've ever seen. Do you want to describe what it was like from your side of the camera, your experience with Chris Cuomo from CNN?
Well, let me give you the quick background.
Yeah,
to
yeah.
RT Communications people sent me a message and said, would you want to go on CNN? And they mentioned the name of Chris Cuomo, and it didn't mean anything to me because I don't watch CNN. So really, it was I was quite surprised to find out who he was after the fact. And they said he wants to do it at 6 o'clock in the morning. And I said, no. And I'm not going to use language because I know you're recording this for your program. But absolutely, I'm not getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning for CNN. And then I went to bed early because I also have a radio program. I was going to do it the next day. Right. And then I wake up and there's these messages. Can you do it at 1:30 in the afternoon? And I said, yes, but not happily. But yes, because it's the cause and the station needs me to do it. So I did. So I showed up. And had a nice chat with the correspondent there, the CNN correspondent here in Moscow, which is a very nice person. Even the live I heard her do seemed decent. Mm-hmm. And then we got started. And my boss, we're getting wired up and everything, and my boss sent me some messages. And he said, be careful. And I said, of course this is a setup. They're going to go after me. They're going to try to spook me, scare me, and then make me run off camera. That's their
right.
plan.
That's right.
And,
that's right.
You know, want me to be, you know, hitting my chest and all of this. And I was fully prepared. And, Don, you've been on my program. You know, we have heated stuff all of the time.
Oh, yeah. You're actually
most people have something interesting to say. This Chris guy had nothing interesting
right.
to say.
That's right. He was repeating the narrative that has been put out by the U.S. media, which even – I listened again on Wednesday, yesterday, to Marie Harf, who's the person filling in for Jen Psaki while she travels, I guess, with Kerry. And you know, they've been promising evidence, and they keep saying they have evidence of the fact that you know, Russia and the people on the ground, who were almost treated like puppets of Russia, were responsible for shooting the airliner down. And so far, they've offered a satellite photo with some, you know, crayons on it, basically.
Yeah, well, you know, you can find all kinds of things on the internet. We both know that. No, I'm glad you bring up that, because this is where Cuomo started to panic. And by the end of the live, he was wanted to run away, not me.
That's right.
He looked very spooked. And I kept pressing the word evidence, your right. evidence. Oh, of course you want to blame Putin and the Russians. Fine, fine. That's your starting point. But let's talk about evidence, forensic evidence. And I pointed out to him, and I'm pretty sure he had no idea what I was talking about. I said, on Monday, the Russian Defense Ministry put on a presentation. It was televised. There was translation that wasn't great. They could have improved upon it. Mm-hmm. But they gave their narrative of what they saw in the air and on the ground. They did not point blame to anyone. They're right. just saying, hey, this is what we got. Take a look at it. Now, we know other people have radars and reconnaissance. Come on, let's sit down and stop fighting and stop pushing narratives, and let's just compare these notes here. Maybe we can get through this here. Absolutely not. Cuomo, he of course, he thought it was a lie because, well, he doesn't know anything about it.
Right.
And this is why this live has been picked up by so many people, because we had parallel narratives. He has the Jen Psaki 10-point talking points, right? And I'm a professional. I look at everything as carefully as I can, even things I don't agree with. I do read the Washington Post because I have to, not because I want to.
Yeah.
But, you know, and this is what happened yesterday, is that you have, he's not a journalist, not at all. No. I mean, he's a drama queen with a camera and a microphone. Let's face it, it was nothing more than that. And all he wants to is to evoke an emotion to for more violence, for more wars. CNN is an outlet for war. Look at it. They even make money off of it. They need a good war because no one else will watch them. Their ratings are in the toilet.
Yeah, it's actually being sold for scrap at this point, with the Murdoch offered to buy it a week and a half ago, and they decided, gee, if we can get that much, let's sell it. But there's no actual entity there, you know, like an institution, a news institution anymore. It's more just some property to dispose of on the market.
Well, they certainly don't have a product that is appealing. I mean, if it's saccharine for people that don't want to be challenged, you know, and this is, it gets down to the point of just being a level of criminality, because you have a society that is so dumbed down. Is it? And this is one of the things that I find truly terrifying, and why I agreed to go on, because there is another way of understanding the world. You know, Don, you and I could talk for a long time, and there'd be things you and I wouldn't agree on.
Right.
But we'd have a dialogue, and we would have a give and take, and you could challenge me, and I would challenge you. Right. What we have right now is, if you challenge us, you are a traitor, you're a bullhorn of propaganda, you're an agent of a foreign power, you're Putin's puppet. That's where it is. It's a binary now.
That's right.
And I'm not going to betray my age, but I was a very, very young man, and there was a debate during the Cold War.
Right.
There was a debate about how much you should engage the Soviet Union. Should there be detente? What should it be? Well, okay, we're enemies, but we can sign arms agreement. There is no reason for Russia and the United States to be enemies, except for the United States does not accept that Russia is a defeated power in the Cold War. Russia opted out of the Cold War. It wasn't defeated.
Right, that's right. We said, enough. Let's concentrate on building our country.
And you know what? For what so many people say about Vladimir Putin, there's one single sentence that he's doing here. He's developing Russia. And he's done a quite remarkable job. And those that have never been here will never see that.
What's remarkable also, I've been watching... And I was looking at this piece with you on CNN yesterday, and generally the situation going on in Ukraine in this context. What hasn't been covered in the American media here, one of the most profound developments in, it may be in human history, depending on how it turns out, this most recent meeting of the BRICS countries in Brazil, where aside from the activities that took place there, the announcement of alternatives to the IMF and the World Bank and a whole lot of other things with huge amounts of money behind them, also the traveling from country to country of both President Putin and President Xi of China, and reaching sanctions-breaking deals between China and Cuba, sanctions-breaking deals between China and Venezuela, support from Russia and China for development all around the hemisphere, which is...
And no isolation of Iran. I think that's very important.
Absolutely true. Yep. And if you compare that to the situation... If Russia, the Soviet Union, and or China were to have as much influence in Latin America back during the Cold War as they do now, they would have declared war from Washington at that point.
It's very interesting. I absolutely agree with you here, because what I see happening in the West right now, particularly in the United States, it's the Titanic. And, you know, that iceberg is there. If you want to look out the window, you can see it. But what are they doing at the State Department? What are they doing in both political parties? They're arguing about the seating arrangement on the deck. That's what they're doing. And what you just said about the BRIC countries and all that, Russia's already decided. You know, a lot of your listeners might not know, but when Putin came to power, when he left prime minister, when Yeltsin resigned, and at the very last day of 1999, he wanted to have a dialogue with the West. He wanted to have a partnership with the West. And a lot of people around him said, oh, Vlad, no, don't, you know, they're not like us. They'll never accept us. And he tried and he tried and he tried. Anti-missile defense, military bases in the post-Soviet space, helping out in Afghanistan. I mean, I could go on and on. And then, no, Russia is not going to be treated like a partner. And then we have the Munich speech in 2007. That was the beginning when he started to listen to better counsel around him. And then in 2008, what do we have? South Ossetia. And this is when they learned their lesson. They're turning more and more away from Western institutions. The thing is, in the 21st century, you get away from these entangling, strangling financial institutions like the IMF, like the World Bank. Then you're free. That's when you have sovereignty. As I speak right now to you, Russia is developing its own SWIFT system. It's developing a new system to do, sell its goods abroad in its own domestic currency. It will use other currencies besides the dollar and the euro. And this time next year, the West is going to begin to feel it. It's not going to be fast. These things take a lot of time. But it's something has been set in motion. So as the White House and 10 Downing Street and these mindless bureaucrats in Brussels argue over the seating arrangement on the Titanic, a good part of the world wants to leave this toxic institutions and mentality and arrogance behind them.
You know, if I were a loan officer for the new institutions that are being created by the BRICS countries and looking to market to the various, you know, people that are going to be the target, countries that need development and don't need to mortgage their future to accomplish short-term development now, I can't think of a better marketing strategy if I had control over it from that those new institutions than to have the United States, the IMF, and the World Bank intensify their bullying of those that are still under their control. And that's what they're doing.
And absolutely right. These new financial institutions don't have all these strings attached. They'll, of course, want a return on their investment.
Sure.
But it's not going. See, the thing is that, you know, the IMF and U.S. foreign policy are very much entwined. You have to sell off your valuable assets. It's already started. You know, the civil war is going on in Ukraine, and people are sniffing around because it's bargain basement prices right now. You know, Ukraine is just a badly run country. Mm. It's not poor.
Right. It's not.
And there are plenty of things in there that can work. Now, they need an enormous amount of investment. And we already know that Joe Biden's son, Hunter, I mean, he's already sitting on a board of a company, an energy company there. I mean, the corpse isn't even cold yet, and they're sniffing around. This is what it's not only that. It's part of a multi-layer, very complex strategy here. When people say it's about NATO, it's about IMF, it's about assets, it's about all of these things, and they're all intertwined.
Imprisoned journalist and political commentator Mumia Abu-Jamal offered his view of the crisis around the crash of Flight 17 from behind the walls.
Malaysia Air and mistakes. The airwaves are thick with talk of war crimes, how Russia should be sanctioned, and even how the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, according to one congressional war hawk, has blood on his hands. This is not to downplay the very real losses sustained in the awful destruction of Malaysia Air 17, but a look at how easily the imperial media slips into war talk and assigning blame. In this environment, military brass are as thick as thieves on corporate media, usually counseling war. Who remembers Iran Air Airbus A300, which was blown to smithereens on July 3rd, 1988? Over 280 souls were killed during this act of destruction because of a missile fired by the U.S. Navy warship Vincentius over the Persian Gulf. Question, was there any talk of war crimes? Was any American president held to account? And remember, this wasn't the act of a non-state, unofficial, badly trained militia. This was the U.S. Navy. The officers aboard Vincenzo's reportedly misidentified the Iranian plane, a civilian craft, as a military flight. Sorry. Oops. My bad. 290 Iranian men, women, and children blown into bits. A war crime or a mistake? From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.